AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to.
And the Oscar goes to.
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
David, it's time to turn the calendar over. The Oscars are over. Emmy season is upon us, and a lot of really good television is upon us. So it's a fun change of topic for us. So you've got two interviews today. And the first one we're going to hear is with Alison Brie, who is on the show Apples Never Fall with an actress who we spent all of Oscar season talking about, Annette Bening. So truly one thing leads into another. But from what I understand, Alison Brie is a real standout on this series as well.
Yeah, it's her first ensemble role in a big series since Glow. And this is an actor who I think a lot of us have come to know in great TV ensembles, Mad Men, Community. So it was a pleasure to see her back in that dynamic. This show is a Leanne Moriarty mystery in which the matriarch of this powerful tennis family, Annette Bening, goes missing. Alison Brie plays one of her children. And as you say, yeah, she's wonderful in it. And it's just great to see her in this kind of mode again.
I love the reminder of Glow because that was such like a special series. It never really felt like it got its due in the era of peak TV we were in when it was airing. And Alison Brie on that show, and I think so much of her post-Community work has been so committed to showing different sides of herself, of what she can do. And it sounds like Apples Never Fall kind of continues in just that vein of her surprising us.
Yeah, that's a real central theme, I think, of this conversation and of how she approached even saying yes to this, the fact that the character is really different from what she's done in the past. She's viewed in the family as a kind of bad girl, and I love the way she plays her in the show because it's really pushing up against that and always playing her with empathy and understanding. And the way that particularly you see this deep bond between her and her mother, again, played by Bening, is really rich and satisfying.
See, Alison Brie is a bad girl. That alone is like, okay, keep showing us variations there. Well, I'm excited to hear, just to watch Apples Never Fall and then to hear what Alison Brie has to say about it. Let's hear your conversation with Alison Brie.
Alison Brie, you are here to talk about Apples Never Fall, all of which is streaming on Peacock. I have a feeling by the time people listen to this, the binge will be done. For me, I watched it rather quickly. Yeah, it better be done. we'll probably spoil a little bit, so people are listening, be aware. But thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's start from the beginning with this one. I think you've said before that you were, after Glow, like a little bit picky about roles you would choose. So I'm curious, what about this one was a yes for you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I was. I mean, I am picky about stuff. I mean, for this, I think the Annette Bening of it all was a big factor, and the Sam Neill. Yeah. I've just always really admired Annette and her work and the things she chooses to work on. And it's like a bucket list thing to work with her. And also a huge fan of Sam Neill and his work. And even more since I met him and worked with him and just adore him. But going into the project, yeah, learning that the two of them were attached and getting to read the first three scripts, I really enjoyed the writing and the family dynamic. And the character. I really like the character. She seemed different than roles that I've played before. And I liked the idea of having tattoos and, you know, being a little spiritual and kind of, you know, I especially the third episode, I felt like there was a lot of really good internal character stuff that I could dive into. And so that felt like it would be fulfilling. And it was.
Yeah, I love that you put it that way. It did feel a little bit different from something that you typically would play, especially at least in a show. I mean, I came to know you through various versions of type A characters, let's say. And what I loved about your performance in this show is you never play her as ridiculous, even though I think she's viewed that way by some members of her family, let's say, and other people in her community. How did you find that center of her where there is this projection that some people see, but in the way we see her through you, there's something a little bit more complicated going on?
Well, I think that's sort of a theme of the show and all of the characters is like how they see themselves versus the way that their family sees them. And we all kind of tend to fall into these roles within our families. And we're always pushing back maybe against the way, you know, the characters that our family has decided that we play. And you're totally right that Amy is viewed as ridiculous by, I would say, almost everyone in her family except for her mom, but just barely. And to me, she is the emotional center of the family. She's kind of the most open, and she's certainly the most emotionally open person in the family, and attempts to be the most honest and is the only communicator. You know, I think that out of everyone in the family, Amy seems to have done the most work on herself and kind of fighting the things that were instilled in her childhood through their father, through the ethos of sports and competition. I feel like she's spent now a lifetime unraveling those things and nobody else has. So even though there's a lot of stuff the family doesn't know about her and there are secrets that have to be revealed to them, I think she's a lot closer than any of the other Delaneys to like knowing her true self and being true to herself. So I think that was sort of my way in to her and just sort of like, you know, finding the truth in that and then always just coming at the scenes from that place.
Were you a fan of Leanne Moriarty coming into the show?
Yeah, definitely. I've read so many of her books, but weirdly hadn't read this book when I got to read the episodes, which was kind of nice because I could kind of go in clean to the show. And, you know, there are some slight changes in from the show to the book. And I felt like that was nice. But I love Leanne's books. They, you know, God, they go down easy. Right. I just feel like they're it's mystery, but it's fun. And yeah, this is no exception.
Yep. And they seem to make their way to TV one by one by one. And people seem to like that.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. So you shot this in Australia, which is a beautiful place to be, as we can see in the show. I'm wondering, like, how that was different for you from past shows. Like, I think both Community and Glow and Mad Men even shot in California and L.A. or around L.A. So this was a departure, literally and figuratively.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah, you're right. I've shot all of the shows I've been on in Los Angeles. I mean, knowing that this was a limited series makes something like that easier. You know, you don't think, oh, I'm going to spend 6 months of the year every year for the unforeseeable future in Australia. Although I have to say, I love it in Australia. I'm actually currently back in Australia now in Melbourne shooting a movie with my husband. So I honestly finished filming that show, filming Apples, and was like, let's move to Australia. I think it, in a way it was really nice because, again, the nature of the show is so centered around this family and their dynamics together and really buying into the fact that this is a family and that underneath all the secrets and the twists and turns, like, there's a comfortability and a unity and a love for one another. And so shooting in a place that was so far from home for all of us, I mean, even our young Aussie castmates, Essie Randles and Connor Merrigan Turner, live in Sydney. We're shooting on the Gold Coast. So nobody's home. And we really spent a lot of time together, and it really bonded us. And I do think you can feel it when you watch the show, that we came to really feel like a family. I feel like even within the greater cast, because we have a lot of amazing supporting characters, and everybody was down in Australia, but there was like a clear distinction of like, this is a Delaney's dinner. And even within the Delaney's, like the siblings, the Sibs are going to the movies. Like, you know, the Sibs are riding together in this van. Like, I think that, but I think it all translated nicely to the show, and it was not work. Yeah, I feel like we all bonded really easily. Yeah. And I think also for me, it was something nice about being far away, and I was able to kind of get lost in the role a little more versus when you're shooting something and then you're going home and, you know, taking out the trash. I mean, I still had to take out my trash.
Sometimes.
But you know what I mean? Fewer like life errands and life stuff, and we could just sort of immerse ourselves in the storytelling.
Suddenly taking out the trash was a thrilling adventure. You never knew where you'd end up.
Where's the trash go here?
Right. It's also interesting just because it's an ensemble show. And so you have, I would imagine, you know, you're not there every second. So your day to day was probably looking a little different than on a typical shoot.
That's so true. I mean, especially given that the last things that I've shot recently were Glow or films like Spin Me Round or Somebody I Used to Know, both of which I co-wrote and produced and starred in. And it was
heavy
like,
involvement.
Heavy involvement all day, every day. This was very different. I can't remember the last time I've worked on a job like this, exactly, where I'm not shooting every day of the week. And that was, you know, it was fun because I got to explore Australia a bit and take trips to Sydney and Melbourne and even just drive around, driving on the other side of the road. Ooh, big adventure. Yeah. But also I think it relaxed me a little bit because probably similar to some of the characters I play, you know, when I'm working, I can get really focused and kind of want to stay, not like I'm staying in character, not method at all, but, you know, mentally staying really responsible and things like that. Like on this job, it's like, if there was a week where I was shooting one day, I'm like, well, I mean, you know, let's lighten up. I think we can have a little fun during the week. You know, it didn't need to be, I don't know, quite so focused. And I actually think that informed the character in a lot of ways too, because she's very, you know, she's letting energy flow through her. She's very in the moment. I felt like I got to kind of embrace that as part of my experience in my day-to-day life shooting in Australia.
Love it. Amy is also, as you mentioned, has a unique relationship with her mother in the show compared to the other siblings, and, you know, vice versa. Amy and her mother they have this bond, and you and Annette get these really touching scenes together, particularly in that third episode that you mentioned. How'd you find working with her and developing that?
Oh, I'm going to cry. I loved it so much. Annette was like, she's just such an incredible actress and a force on set, and the way that she carries herself, handles herself as a working professional is totally inspiring, and she couldn't be more generous. I felt like when we were shooting scenes, especially some heavier moments, you know, of take the space you need, and very, I think in sort of like a mentorship role, sort of helping to give me space or make sure, you know, do you have everything you need? Is the crew, are we giving the moment that, you know, I just felt very supported by her. And there's a scene we shot that is the opening scene in the third episode where we're in a car together, and we finished shooting that scene, and I turned to her with tears in my eyes and just was like, this is very special to me, being able to shoot a scene like this with you. She's just one of my idols truly for as long as I can remember. And anyway, and she said, I feel the same. And we hugged. It was very sweet. I adore her. She's like, it's the opposite of when people say, don't meet your heroes. You know, I'm so glad that I got to work with her, and And also she's so funny and fun too, and doesn't take it all too seriously. It's like the perfect balance of all the things you want in a partner on set.
It's such a fascinating role too for her, because it's, the structure of the show is such that you're kind of waiting for that big moment. And then of course the, every episode is centered on a different character. Yours is the third, and the finale is her episode. And you're just like, oh, she's arrived.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, I love that it's a true ensemble show. It really yeah. is. And like, aside from it being a cushy schedule, it really was a fun sort of communal experience between all of us as actors. And it, I felt like you could feel the giving and the taking of support at any given moment in a really real way, and the passing of the baton. And like, I just think we all had, everyone was really much really there for each other. And we had an awareness of like, this is my moment and the cast is supporting me. And now this is so-and-so's moment and this scene is about them, and nobody's in the background trying to have, you know, and I'm going to cry really loud while they're crying. You know, I just feel like there was really nice balance to everyone's performances, and Annette included. But it's also kind of like, as much as the show is structured around an episode per character, everybody has something to do in mm-hmm. every episode, because you're sort of untangling this web of all of these relationships in the family. So that was kind of interesting to me, that your way into each episode is a specific character, but still everybody's going through something collectively, individually. And also, like, I was so fascinated by every relationship within the family, sibling to sibling, every sibling to the parent. Like, they're all different. Every relationship is different and unique.
Yeah, that's why the show really resonated with me, was it's just like, it has special care, I think, for all these different dynamics in a way that I'm sure is also very nice for an actor.
Totally. Yeah, it was so fun. Also, because we're going, I mean, going back and forth between the present and the past. And yeah, every day it was exciting to play like, oh yeah, this is that moment between two sisters when they hate each other. But moments later, we can just laugh about something because we're sisters and we love each other. I mean, I don't have a big family, but I do have a sister and we love each other. But it's, you know, your family, it's fun. It was fun always to meet. Some of my favorite scenes were with Essie Randles, who plays Brooke, the youngest sibling, and just these sister moments, even after a fight where neither ever says the actual words, I'm sorry, but they are able to communicate that to each other in their own ways and know that that's what they're saying. Like that unspoken language within a family, and specifically between sisters. I really loved that.
Was there anything kind of interesting for you and Jake just about being two siblings of four? And then you had Essie and Connor, who were playing your siblings, who are Native Australians, coming at this from a different angle, I would imagine. Like, how did you find the two halves coming together?
Oh, it was great. It was sort of all of the six of us in the DeLaneys. It felt like these three generations sort of like Annette and Sam, like pros and the icons. And then me and Jake, like working actors, you know, been doing this for a while.
Bringing that American intensity.
Yeah. And then Essie and Connor, you know, excited, first big job. Like, I think it was really fun for Jake and I to take on, you know, a mentorship role for them a little bit. And it's always mm-hmm. fun to get to tell all your stories to somebody. And I think we did feel a responsibility on the one hand to kind of look out for them and stuff like that. And at the same time, you know, we're all equals on the set. And I feel like I couldn't help but get caught up in like their energy and enthusiasm also, which was really fun. And yeah, if anything, it's what is it? Jake and I just giving a healthy dose of skepticism and, oh, well, we've been around the block a few times, you know, sharing our stories, I think was really fun.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor. Let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
You mentioned GLOW earlier, and that remains one of mine and many's, you know, of those COVID memories of what happened to that show, a true tragedy. But I thought of it in a bad way during the strikes, because you guys got shut down. And I was wondering if you had like a bad sense of deja vu.
Gosh. No, I weirdly didn't think about that during the strikes, because I guess we had finished a lot more of this right. show than we had finished, you know, season four of GLOW. We had shot an episode and a half. When we broke for the strikes on this show, we had shot 5 out of 7. I was like, there's no way they're not going to finish this show. We've done so much right. already. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm an optimist at heart. I know I just said that about Jake and I sharing skepticism, but I truly do live in a positive space most of the time.
Right. I'd love to zoom out a little bit and just talk about, I suppose, what that post-GLOW moment looked like for you. I think you got more into writing and producing. Now that it's a little bit more in the rear view, you make a show like this. Like, I suppose, generally, what kind of things are you looking for? Are you still looking for that kind of ownership in a way that came about more at that point?
I don't know. I guess so. I mean, I'm really looking for another great ongoing show. I've been so lucky to have worked on Mad Men and Community and GLOW, and I feel like I'm most comfortable being on a show, an ongoing show. Apple's was so fun. I loved working with these people so much. It made me wish it was an ongoing show, you know, and not a limited series. And actually, that was sort of a weirdly, if I'm allowed to say this, a fun part about returning after the strikes is it almost felt like we were returning for a second season you know, where we already, we're so familiar already with each other and our surroundings. You're not breaking ice again. You know what I mean? Everyone coming back like, hey, Brooksy, you know, like, it's like, you know, all the transpo guys, it's like, it did sort of feel like coming back for a second season. And God, I can't think of people that I would rather do that with after the experience we had shooting, because it was so wonderful. But yeah, it's so daunting. And it is, like I said before, about GLOW and those other shows having set the bar really high. And so it's like, there's nothing I'd want more than to just be working on a great ensemble show again, that's ongoing and continuing. But it's just, you just want it to be right and you want it to be perfect. I'm not perfect, but you want to really feel it. I don't know if you're going to sign on to something that's might be years of your life. So there's that. And certainly, you know, I'm still enjoying, I've taken a little break from writing, but my husband and I are co-producing this horror film that we're starring in right now, which I'm really enjoying. I've been thinking more and more about directing a film, but it's the same, which I really want to do it, but it's the same type of thing where it's just like, what's the project that's gonna ignite the passion enough to carry me through that kind of time commitment and just the fear, you know, the scariness of taking that leap and the vulnerability that comes with that.
I cannot imagine making a movie with my husband.
Oh, we're
different people.
Yes. Yes.
It's interesting because I first started watching you, I think the Community and Mad Men were on at the same time for a little bit.
Yeah.
And we were in this like unbelievably exciting period for TV. And these are both really long running shows in a way that, it's hard to get those made nowadays. And
yeah,
it's been interesting to track like your career, because you look at GLOW and it's kind of at the height of this Netflix boom. And now you're in this, you know, frothy, fun, limited series at the time when those are kind of rising up. You're very much in tune with the eras of television as they evolve.
I'm so glad. That's so interesting. Again, I think it's just dumb luck, you know? I think it's just, and trying to make good choices. I mean, again, Mad Men and Community, because those were two of my first jobs, really it was the luck of the draw. Like there was no, there was no audition I was turning down, you know, when I was booking Mad Men and Community. And so like the odds that I could have ended up on any other pilot that didn't go, you know what I mean? It's just as high as having ended up on those amazing shows. And then of course had more agency in sort of choosing to pursue GLOW, but even that, and I've talked at length about this before, but even that was a long audition process, you know? Right. So now it is, again, it's sort of, as you get more agency, you get to sort of choose your projects more. It almost, it's scarier, right? It's scarier. Yeah. The stakes feel a little higher. Like I did this to myself.
Shouldn't have said no to that.
Yeah, exactly. But ultimately it's just about doing good work, doing work that's fulfilling. And I think, and hopefully trying something new and different, trying to show a different side of myself or explore a different side, a different type of character than I've played before. Mm-hmm. And yeah, to that end, I have some series in development, but the development road is long and uncertain and knows strange. If those will ever see the light of day. Yeah. So we persevere, you know?
We persevere. I like that. Yeah, that's what we do. It's also, I mean, I also just hearing you talk about the kind of that moment of opportunity and agency and the kind of double-edged sword of that. With you, thinking of Mad Men and Community, they were both in that kind of character type that you were talking about. Did you find it was also like navigating, maybe I want to do something different and people aren't offering that stuff to me as much, things like that?
Yeah. It's funny because at the time when I was shooting those shows simultaneously, they couldn't have felt more different to me. Right. So it actually was like a surprise to me that I was like, oh, people think these characters are the same. Like, yeah. And that's my thing. Yeah. It was all sort of a surprise and new and just my introduction to the business at large and the trope of typecasting and things like that. Again, to me, I feel like GLOW was a departure from that. I don't know if everybody felt it was. But certainly that is what led me down the road of writing material for mm-hmm. myself. I think that certainly was kind of my reaction to not getting opportunities to do to flex different muscles and do different types of things. And I mm-hmm. feel like the three films that I've co-written, Horse Girl and Spin Me Round and Somebody I Used to Know, mm-hmm. are all quite different from each other.
Very.
And the characters are different in them. And sort of some, they're more personal to me, but each in different ways. And so that certainly was really fun and a response to what you're talking about. But with shows, it's hard. I mean, and then this, you know, was a response to that too. I read this, when I first got the script, I saw the character breakdowns and I thought they were sending me the role of Brooke, which is described as, you know, type A, owns a, you know, physical therapy business, father's favorite. And then I kind of was like, oh, it's the Amy role. That made me really excited that even getting sent material to play a role that seems so different. I was very flattered and excited to do that. So I guess, yeah, when I look towards like the projects I'm developing, those characters are quite different. And that is part of why I like a hand in being involved in something early to try and shape that. All of that said, if the right project comes around and the writing is really great and the people involved are really wonderful, I'm not like, no more type A characters ever again.
Yeah.
And I also think, look, let's be honest. Like, I must just have some of that in my personality and it may end up coming through in any role I play. Like, I can't fight it.
Yeah, there you go. I cannot comment on that. Only you know.
I don't even totally know, but it's right. Like, you know, we can't ignore it.
You're like, maybe the there is something to Trudy Campbell and me as I go into my sixth year here.
Yeah, totally.
You mentioned taking a break from writing. I'm a fan of the movies you've written, so I'm wondering if I can ask you why.
Thank you. Oh, it's so hard. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
I feel you.
I think I don't know. Maybe just waiting for inspiration as well. And if I look at the things that, you know, the areas in which I've been able to work, even like directing an episode of GLOW and an episode of, you know, Marvel 616 for Disney+, like if I were ranking things, I'd be like, obviously acting is where I feel most comfortable. It comes so naturally to me. It's like pure joy, you know, and I think actually directing is the next one that I felt super empowered doing it. And it, that was really gratifying. And writing, it's just like, I don't know, certain things, if the inspiration is there, then it has been fun and easy. And because it's what I'm newest at, perhaps. Prior to Horse Girl, really never thought I would write anything. Wouldn't think of myself as a writer. Mm-hmm. Still feel very, very shy about categorizing myself in that way. I just think it doesn't come as naturally to me. And like, maybe I just don't even have also like that, the like writer's work ethic, the way I do even about acting and taking on characters or even producing, you know, to be like, well, I should sit down and try to write something. I'm like, ugh, I don't know. Sounds like a lot of work. Like I just, right. I think, but who knows? I think that inspiration may strike. I'm really proud of the projects that I've written. I love them so much. And I love writing with my husband, you know, just thinking that's the most recent thing that we've written. And again, we work really well together, and like co-producing right now is really fun. So I'm not saying it's over forever. I just sort of realized, ooh, I was feeling a little burnt out or less excited about it or something, and thought like, it was kind of nice to go work on Apples and just be acting and have fun and be able to let go of like, yeah, thinking about all the logistics, I guess. Yes,
there you go. Well, speaking of logistics, I'm going to be the first person ever to ask you about the Community movie.
Yes.
I'll leave it to you. I mean, I know Joel said that you guys are going to film it this year. But people are excited.
I'm so glad people are excited. I'm excited. I love those guys. I truly love the cast of Community so much. To make an Apples comparison, like they really feel like my family. Yeah. And I think everything we went through, we had so much fun shooting that show. And also, you know, it was long hours and some wild things happened, I think, on that set. But at the same time, my memories of shooting Community are just laughing until we're all crying and having to lean over so that the tears aren't ruining our makeup. And it's like that every time we get together, that whole gang. And of course, our text chain is going strong. And so I'm really excited. I did get a phone call recently checking some availability for later this year. So that's good. But we still don't have a script. So that's the main thing. Just waiting on that script. Putting a little pressure out there.
But as you said, it's a process. Writing is a process. So we got to give Dan time.
We understand this. Yes. And I know that anything Dan is going to come up with is going to be so brilliant and extraordinary. So can't wait.
So now, David, you've got another conversation with Anthony Boyle, who is incredibly busy this spring with roles on both Masters of the Air and Manhunt. He's really running the gamut of history, it seems like. And these are kind of big, crowded shows with a lot of other stars on them. But from what you're saying, he's a real standout in both.
He's amazing in both. And it's really amazing to watch him, particularly in Masters of the Air, where he's surrounded by Barry Keoghan, Callum Turner, Austin Butler, and I think he runs away with the thing. He's the narrator of the series. It's basically the last in this sort of Band of Brothers Pacific trilogy that began on HBO, these epic war limited series. And he is just magnetic. And it was a pleasure to watch him on the show. And obviously we get screeners in advance, so we don't necessarily know when everything's coming out. And it kind of dawned on me as we were preparing for Emmy's coverage that Masters of the Air would end the week that Manhunt, in which he plays John Wilkes Booth, would begin. And it's just an unbelievable kind of continuity there. And it's a pleasure to just keep having him on screen because he is among the best on TV this spring, I think.
Yeah, he's been on a lot of different shows that I think, you know, if you watch them, you know who he is on Dairy Girls. But if you don't, you don't. And for me, that's The Plot Against America, which is a series that I just loved and came out in the depths of the pandemic and no one wanted to be depressed by it. But he was wonderful on that. And so it's exciting to see him kind of pivoting off of, you know, whatever that momentum was from those shows into these two bigger roles.
So he spent a good amount of time sort of counting the amount of people who watched Plot Against America, because according to him, it's five people. And I am identified as one. His parents are two. And I forgot to mention you, Katie, but you would have been the fourth out of five. So there's only one person left.
Small but mighty army we have going for us here. Well, let's hear more about John Wilkes Booth and everything else in your conversation with Anthony Boyle.
Well, Anthony Boyle, as we speak, Masters of the Air has just finished airing on Apple TV Plus, and Manhunt, another series that you were in, has just started airing. It was very nice of them to plan things out that way just for you, right?
It was. I bribed Tim Cook to do it that way. That's the way to do it. It is, man. I think it's a nice, it's either a nice coincidence or a nice bit of marketing. I don't know which is which.
Yeah, it's worked out. They're very different shows. I think what they have in common is they're these kind of epic genre portraits of American history. And as people can probably hear, you are not American, which we'll get into a bit more later. I'm just curious, like, what your relationship is to these two projects. Like, when did you film them? Did you film them back to back? Like, how do you think square them now in your head side by side?
Yeah, we shot Masters of the Air 2021, I think, and it was like, you know, the height of the pandemic, so COVID was rife, and we were filming it in England, and then I rapped, and the job I was doing after was Booth. Like, the Booth thing came through, and it was he felt like just the polar opposite of Harry Crosby. Mm-hmm. Harry Crosby felt like motivated by like love, and he was kind of nervous, and then Booth was just an asshole. He was motivated by hate and racism, all this sort of bile, you know. And I thought it would be a good project to jump into. They were two or three months after, just enough time for me to squeeze out a possible mustache. yeah.
Thank you for answering my question as to whether or not it was real.
Yeah, it was. Well, some of the scenes it was real, because we shot out of order. So I'd say 70% of it is Boyle's mustache and 30% Booth.
What kind of experience do you have with mustache growth? Did you know the kind of care requirements, things like that?
No, it was a revelation for me. I didn't know I could grow one. So it was a kind of, you know, race against the clock. But I'd say after about the month and a half mark, I was quite confident that I was going to get that full handlebar, you know, YMCA situation that I got in the piece.
All right. Yeah, I don't know if I could grow one. I've never tried, so.
You should try, man. This is what this podcast is for, to inspire you to grow some fish.
You are inspiring me, because you're a fellow novice. So, and look, yeah, honestly, man, anyone who watches Manhunt will not doubt your ability to grow a mustache going forward. Well, you have this quote in the Masters of the Air finale that I thought actually fed quite nicely into Manhunt. It's a Nietzsche quote. You say, "Whoever fights monsters should take care not to become a monster himself." And then, of course, you are kind of playing a monster in Manhunt. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious how you found that shift from hero to villain, essentially. Obviously, you don't play the villain, right? But he's the villain of the piece for
I'm glad you purposes. Picked up that quote, man. I pulled that quote. I found I was reading it, and I sent it to John Orloff, the writer, and he stuck it in, which I was very, very happy about. It's a great quote, and I think it really sums up sort of Crosby's emotional landscape in that point. You know, they're both sort of motivated politically. I mean, Crosby's killing, like, he's responsible for the death of, like, hundreds, thousands of people. But it's sort of the way we've scored it off is, like, it's for the greater good. Whereas Booth killed one person, but it's, you know, because of the way it was, you know, it's like sort of... Booth thinks he's a hero and he's a villain. Crosby is wrestling with his morality and for that moment thinks he may be a villain, but he is a hero. And it's like, I just found it so interesting. I found the quote interesting because of, like, it exists in a, like, gray area. It's not like black and white. Like, he is killing people. You know, he will be responsible for the death of women and children, but it's for the greater good. So it's in this kind of weird, you know, I can understand why men of that era didn't speak about their war experiences. I feel like a lot of them, there's two categories. They either left and never spoke about it again, or the left, and they speak about it constantly. It's mm-hmm. like their whole personality. It's like they you know, attend all the events, and it's such an intense thing.
Mm. Going to start with Masters of the Air a little bit more. I know you and your fellow actors went through quite a training regimen for that show. I think you did for both, but you know, this is an instance where you're, I know you've been a part of big projects before, but you're walking in with these other, you know, younger rising actors. You've got this unbelievable producing team. You know, anyone who watches the show can know just how massive of a production this is, like with the training, but also just how did you find getting your bearings in such an environment over a pretty extensive shoot?
I loved it, man. It was like, you know, it was during COVID. So like you were either just had to stay in your hotel or, you know, stay in your house because London was on full lockdown. So going to set every day and there was 250 lads and we were all just, you know, fucking around, having the crack and doing this TV show. You know, like when you're growing up, you want to be in Band of Brothers. Like if you're a young actor, you're like, oh, that's what I want to be in, you know, or the Pacific. So to be in it, we were all just thrilled, man. We were all just so buzzed. And it was such a good cast. Like I remember the first day of filming, we were doing this like bar scene. And it's like the scene in episode 2 where we were having a conversation with the Brits. And I was looking around the table. It's like Colin Turner, Austin Butler, Barry Keoghan, Louis Gredrick. It was just so many like, class actors, just like, just in like a pure state of like flow. You know, it's just on day one, it just like really just hit the ground running. And I looked around and I was like, I think this is going to be good. And I think this is going to be a good show.
Yeah.
So I loved it, man. I had such a good experience on.
Did you guys, I mean, even beyond just like the standard bonding that comes with being on a show like that, in the same vein of Band of Brothers, you guys are all actors of a certain generation. I mean, did you find yourselves talking about careers, how you want to navigate the business from here, stuff like that?
No, man, we just talked about football and the sesh and whiskey. I don't think there was too much chat about like career progression or anything like that. Maybe we should have, but you know, it is,
I think you guys are doing okay.
We spoke about the work, you know. We spoke about like, oh, what's the crack? What's going on in this scene and stuff? But not, it was never like, you know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? It wasn't like it wasn't that sort of thing.
Yeah. Did you find differences in like process, prep, stuff like that between you?
Yeah, kind of. Man. Everyone's got their own little thing. That's what I was saying on that day one. Everyone was doing their own sort of thing, but in unison. It's just interesting to see everyone else's sort of different techniques or method, and then just like sort of blend into one. And that was good about having such a big cast of 250 people. Like everyone's coming in with such different ideas and such different, you know, like approaches to the work. And when you've got, I think that's what sometimes like exciting things happen. You know, if people are coming at it from such different angles, you know, can sometimes melt into like something really, really exciting that both people didn't expect.
In terms of that kind of prep of playing somebody real, you had a lot of material to look at, go through. How does that change the way you go into a part versus like how you do like a Harry Potter? Like, obviously, that's a different kind of thing.
Well, with Harry Potter, I think I was because there's like that's such a wacky world. So Harry Potter, I was looking at I was playing a Malfoy, and I looked at they were like purebred and pure blood. Mm-hmm. So I looked at like purebred dogs, and I looked at like what happened to like pugs when they were purebred, and their larynxes got so tight, and they're just completely fucked. So I just started to, you know, tighten my larynx and do this kind of like weird kind of like breathy voice. And you can sort of, if you're doing something of that world, like Harry Potter, you can have fun with it and play around in that sort of regards. But when you're playing someone real and there's so much source material and video clips and footage, the process is a little bit different because there is a bit of mimicry involved in the beginning because you're trying to get that sound or cadence. Like for Crosby, I had this great 10-minute clip of him in the nose of a B-17. When he's about 70. And when I first heard it, he's got this kind of a crazy kind of rhythm in the way he talks, and it's kind of goes on and on. And I just really liked, that rhythm that he had. And then he had this beautiful kind of like childlike quality to his eyes, even though he's seen so much, been through so much, lost so much people. he had this like real kind of brightness. You know, you just see people like that, like they just radiate some sort of inner goodness or kindness. Mm-hmm. So I was just trying to like use that and play with that. And like the difference between that and someone like Booth, there's these photos of Booth and he's sat there and he's getting this photo taken and his chest is pumped out and he's just leading with his chest and his balls and his eyes are just like, he's got this 1,000-yard stare and he's just staring down the camera and you can just see he's tapped. There's just something not right with him. Yep. And there's a darkness in him. And it's like, that's the difference. Just a photo can sort of spark so much for you creatively, you know, because you go, all right, what was he like just before he took that photo? Hardly speak to a photographer, you know, and then suddenly you're going, okay, cool. I kind of get this guy, you know? Hmm.
It's interesting though, like you saying that, I mean, when you step into shoes that are that disturbed, right? Mm. And dark, like, what are you like right before the camera starts rolling and after?
Well, I find it helpful if like I sort of stay in the accent when I'm filming because it helps me feel a bit more like the character and it probably helps everyone else in the scene as well. Like if 2 seconds before and I'm going, all right, what's the crack? What are we doing? Are we shooting Lincoln here? Hey, motherfucker, I'm going to shoot you in that. You know, like it probably would take everyone else out of it. Yeah. So it helps me to sort of stay in the accent a little bit and the physicality. And then if you're doing something emotional, I try to kind of be in the emotional state of whoever I'm or whatever's happening. You know, if like, I can't do that thing where people are like, you know, oh, hey, what do you want for lunch? Oh, yeah, we're going to go out tonight. And then, oh, I can't believe my mother's just died. I can't make that switch. I have to sort of, I don't know, bleed into it a little bit. Not in an annoying way, not in a sort of like, you know, I'm going to hinder anyone else around me, but just in a kind of, you know, just if you've got to do something quite like intense or emotional, just taking yourself off and just chilling on your own for a bit can be helpful to focus and get into that emotional state.
Yeah. At the risk of blowing smoke, it's a pretty amazing embodiment of a terrible guy. I was really taken with the way you play him. And it reminded me of some like great on-screen villains. I'm curious if you had any, and if there's anyone in that vein that you loved in films, shows, these villains who take up a lot of space, but then you see them maybe in a different way than you expect at the outset.
What did I watch? I watched some Daniel Day and some Joaquin. I mean, you can't go wrong when you're like, you know, for the prep, I was like, that's the kind of performance I kind of want. I was like, that's what I feel like he should be like. One of those kind of things. So I was watching some of their stuff, you know, Gangs in New York and The Master and whatever, and just seeing like, you know, those kind of performances was what I was trying to do, you know.
Can you say a little bit more about like what about them you wanted to approach, I guess?
Yeah, there's like a level of intensity, I suppose. I feel like those two actors also aren't afraid to like paint with like large brushstrokes. They can be the most subtle and beautiful of actors, but also sometimes they make these just like insane big choices, and I felt like that was kind of what was needed for Booth. He was like a larger than life personality and this charismatic actor, you know, maybe a more subtle approach wasn't needed. It needed to be something that would, you know, fill the screen.
Can you talk to me a little bit about Cowboy Camp, as I believe you called it?
Man, I'd never ridden a horse before, and I showed up, and obviously sort of like a lot of the show I'm on a horse. And I showed up and they gave me these cowboy boots and I'd grown out the mustache. You're going into like a very masculine, macho environment. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go up here and take ownership. So I walked up to the cowboy camp and there's like 6 cowboys around me. They're like, hey, how you doing? How you getting on? And the big firm handshakes and stuff. And I walk right up to this horse and the horse is massive. And I look up at him and I go, how do I get on him? And one of the cowboys goes, figure it out. And I'm like, oh God, so I have to clamber up onto this horse. And I'm sat there and I go, how do I make him go? And he goes, kick him. And I'm like, what? He goes, kick him. So I kick the horse and we start like galloping a little bit. And because I always try to run before I can walk, I kick him again, and the horse just like flies.
Oh man!
And I'm like just holding on for dear life, and I'm like, how do I make him stop? And the cowboy goes, figure it out. So I like pull the reins in the bit, and the horse just stops in a dime. And one of the cowboys comes up and he goes, how do you know how to do that? And another cowboy goes, he's Irish. It's in his blood. And from there on in, that was like day one of cowboy camp. And from that then on in, I was like, I would just show up with a bottle of whiskey. We would chew tobacco. And yeah, just trying to get into that machismo, that kind of, you know, because they've got that old-timey kind of thing that Booth would have had. And, yeah. It was really useful for that pick, you know, and even just things like you see them in a conversation bend down, pick off a blade of grass, stick it in the mouth, and then you're on set, you're doing a scene, you go, all right, I'll do that. And that's, you know, just and it just makes it a bit more richer, you know, just a bit more lived in.
Yeah. I love that sight of the cowboy. I wonder if you ever have had a moment like that where you're like, God, I've been in America too long.
No, I love America, man. I think this place is so funny. Like a reality TV show every day. Yeah, I love it.
Sure is.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
I read that you first learned of John Wilkes Booth through a Simpsons episode, which is also probably true for me. When I read that quote at first, I laughed. And then I was like, you know what? I definitely watched that when I was pretty young. And I definitely didn't know who he was before. So there you go. Some Americans are with you there. But
no judgments.
No judgments at all. And a good way to learn about him, you know. Simpsons has some...
Man, all my American references have came from rap music, The Simpsons, or Family Guy. Like, you know, that's where I know about America.
I think it's true of a lot of Americans too, so you're fine.
Grand. It was an episode of The Simpsons where Bart Simpson is, he's playing Booth.
Yep.
And Milhouse is playing Abraham Lincoln, and Bart comes on stage and he says, hasta la vista, AB. And
yes,
that's who I built the character around. Built it all on Bart Simpson.
There you go. Single direct line.
I kept trying to improv eat my shorts, but they wouldn't take it.
Next Simpsons inspired project.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, because like I think Manhunt has this really interesting, nuanced take on really like a nation at a crossroads, right? Mm-hmm. Around this manhunt that it depicts. Masters of the Air, which we're talking about, is this, you know, kind of end of this trilogy, right? Of this portrait of war. And I came to know you first in Plot Against America, which is another great portrait of American history in a particular moment.
So you were one of the five people that saw it.
I 100% was. That show was not done right. In my opinion.
I know. I wish more people saw. I thought it was such a good show.
It was. It was like David Simon at his best.
David Simon, man. Yeah. That's how I got cast in Master, though. Gary Getzman and Steve Scherzen at Playtone saw Plot Against America. And they were the other two or five people that saw it. The other two remains.
I want to know. Yeah, we've got two left. Let's find
them. My mom and dad. So they saw it. And about 5 years ago, called me into the Playtone offices in LA, and they were in pre-production for Masters, and they were like, "We want you to be a part of this. We just don't know what role." And I was walking around. There was like, you know, model B-17s and models of all the, you know, air bases and stuff. And you have so many meetings like that, and then you just, it never comes to fruition or whatever. And then
right.
like 4 years later, 3 years later, they were like, oh, remember that army thing? Yeah, they want you to read for it. I was like, oh, fuck, that's happening.
Wow.
So yeah, Proud Against America. Shout out David Simon.
Everyone who watched it clearly left an impact. That's what matters.
Yeah, all five people.
all five people. And you did that show right after you finished Harry Potter on Broadway, right?
Yeah, man.
So again, I mean, it's the kind of thing where you're talking about going in these rooms, you never know what's going to come of it, but it was a great part. It was a great show, but like, why was that the one? Because I think you'd been doing Potter for like 3 years at that point, right?
Yeah, I've been doing Harry Potter for 3 years, and I was playing a, you know, English like wizard. So it was like coming off the back of that, there was a couple of different projects I was going to do, and then Plot Against America was this like cocky New York Jewish young man who wanted to go and become a soldier, and it just felt like the more interesting role. And David's such a good writer. I've obviously loved The Wire and all that stuff, and Winona Ryder was in it and John Turturro, and I thought, oh, well, that's the kind of route I want to go down. You know, I want to go down that kind of and follow that kind of work. And the writing was just so good. I mean, David Simon, he's the best writer America has. Like, it was just an absolute joy to say those words.
How did you find like kind of getting out of the Potter rhythm? I would imagine it would even just, you know, change you a little bit as an actor, having done that for so long and so successfully, and then coming into the big old world of American series television.
Well, it's weird because your body doesn't know you're acting. If you're doing it right, your body doesn't know that you're acting. So you're actually feeling fear. You're actually feeling pain, hurt, or whatever you put yourself into. So if you're doing that 8 shows a week, like, I have to lose my mother quite early on in the play. So after we finished Potter, like, for about 2 weeks after, at about 7:20, I would just burst into tears. And I wouldn't know why. It's because my body had been so used to going through this really like a traumatic thing every single day. So yeah. I'd be on a date trying to ask a girl, what's her fucking star sign? And I'm just like crying my eyes out for no reason. I'm like, sorry, I just finished the play. Sorry, just give me a minute. So it's just this kind of like strange thing that your body gets into such an emotional rhythm of doing that for 3 years. And then suddenly you stop and your body's completely out of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good to jump into that Plot Against America role. I really liked it.
So naturally, my next question then is like, how did you leave Masters of the Air and Manhunt? Those are both emotionally intense roles in different ways too, I would think.
Yeah, I don't know. I've got better as you get older to like just sort of leave it at work, you know, leave it out all out in the pitch, and just, you know, when they call cut, you go home and have a cup of tea, you know. Uh-huh. I think when I was younger, it was a bit more intense, but particularly when you're doing theater and you're doing it every single night. But I found it easy just to leave it when you're done, go back to Ireland, you know, swim in the sea, drink 17 pints of Guinness and have fun, you know. It's like an easy way to get out of it.
And you've picked up some skills. You've picked up riding a horse, flying a plane, I think, right?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, why not?
Why not? Why not? Good byproduct of being an actor, I guess.
Yeah, tell them I can fly a plane. No, I had to learn how to navigate. But I don't think I would trust myself to navigate an actual B-17. But yeah, I learned how to ride horses. My mate's uncle tried to sell me a horse a couple of days ago. Because we were up riding, and he's like, this is the horse for you, son. This is $3,500. I'll take care of him. And I was like, so wait, you want me to give you $3,500 and then you'll just have the horse? And he's like, yep. I was like, I don't know if this sounds like a good deal for me. But I'm not sure this is actually working out for me. But yeah, so I've kept on the riding horses, but I haven't been flying too many planes.
No, not yet. Just in hearing you in this conversation, it's clear you have a love for accents, dialects.
Yeah.
And I think in everything I've seen you in, it's been different and American, I guess. How do you go about like getting an accent right? What do you love about different voices? Because you can slip in and out quite easily. I'm already hearing it.
I like that it it's usually the first place I start. I don't have a straight answer for it, but it just I do feel like it's one of the most important things for me. And then I think it informs the psychology and the you know, it's like kind of like outside in. It's like not going for the psychology first and stuff. It's like going, how does he sound? How does he move? And then letting that inform the inner life.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's something about the way you speak as Booth that immediately, for me, you get this insight into that darkness underneath. It's just like even just the patterns of speech.
Yeah. Thanks.
Is it something that you pick up on as you're doing it, or do you find it's more informing the way you're going through it almost?
I work with a great dialect coach on that called Cynthia Blaz, because I wanted to have this kind of like bassy kind of thing for him. I wanted to have someone who would have like an old actor's, you know, he toured on stage for a long time, that kind of like transatlantic, almost English thing. But then I also wanted this kind of Southern thing, so we could have that kind of like sympathy with the Southern states. You know, I didn't want it to sound like anyone else in the piece. I wanted it to sound like, you know, kind of this, just kind of, I don't really think he knows who he is. So this kind of like made up kind of thing, you know, just put all that in a melting pot and how does he sound?
Right. Lastly, I will ask you, what is the secret to a perfect Spencer Tracy impression? Because yours is pretty good.
What are you going to say? What's the secret to growing a mustache? I don't know, man. He's such a good actor. I love all those boys from back in the day. All those old actors are so, I don't know, they're so clean or something. You watch the performances and they're always so clean. You know exactly what they're feeling.
That does it for today's interview episode. We'll be back on Thursday with our predictions for the 2025 Oscars, believe it or not. In the meantime, find us at Vanity Fair and on social media at VF Awards Insider. You can find me out there at Katie Rich and David.
David Canfield, 97.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.